Welcome, welcome. I am very interested today in our guest and what he has to say. It's a hugely important topic. AI regulation is massive. The AI Act, it actually affects every business in the world, despite the fact that it's the EU AI Act. It affects the UK, it affects Europe, obviously, and also America and any other country that wants to sort of deal in Europe. And Michael Charles Borelli is a leading expert in this area in AI regulation. He's specializing in the AI Act, in the EU AI Act, excuse me, and its implications for businesses. He operates in AI, Web 3.0, and of course, financial services, which is a key area here. So, yeah, I mean, I think first of all, Michael, welcome. Really nice to see you, and looking forward to sort of digging into this very interesting conversation here.
Thank you so much for having us on. It's a pleasure to be here, and on behalf of the AI Partners team, being able to speak about AI regulation and sort of demystify a few things is a pleasure. So, and big fan of the work you guys are doing.
Welcome to Influential Visions. Here we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. Here is your host, Nathaniel Schuller.
So important, the AI Act. And EU are, I mean, would you say that they are leading the way here with this, or are there regulations anywhere else in the world that are kind of, you know, leading in this area?
Bias and prejudice aside, of course, yes, I would say that they are leading the way in this area. They have launched and implemented the world's first comprehensive law on AI. So prior to the 1st of August 2024, there are soft law initiatives and voluntary codes of conduct and various aspects around this that were implemented by companies but had no legally binding effects, and certainly no formal implementation at a national and global level. Whereas with the EU AI Act, similar to how GDPR is implemented for AI for data regulation, the EU AI Act is the AI equivalent. And maybe we'll go into this further down the line, but they've institutionalized a whole new compliance infrastructure to govern this regulation. So that includes government authorities, broad divisions of the European Commission, a European AI board, national authorities. So you name it, there's a whole AI governance and regulation compliance ecosystem being set up, which means this is not just another very abstract EU regulation or attempt by EU to, some may say, impose barriers. It's to implement the safe deployment of AI, which, as leading scholars and thought leaders would have, is possibly the most important technological breakthrough in human history.
Absolutely. That's very interesting. I mean, look, you know, I spend a lot of time talking to these kind of scholars. I've got a friend who's in one of the top 10 universities in the world, and he is actually deeply worried about AI. Are you sort of worried about AI in terms of jobs and things like this personally? Or
I'm extremely optimistic, because one of the traits that makes humanity extremely, ready for change is its ability to be resilient and adapt. And I think to touch on the EU AI Act, it very much fosters a human-centric approach. And there are various, as you mentioned, scholars talk about this, namely people like Yuval Noah Harari, talk about human resilience. So resilience to change, resilience in many other aspects, is what makes humanity very strong. Also, its ability to come together in groups. I use the example, if you had one chimpanzee or a lion versus a human, the human would lose out. However, if you have a group of humans come together, they become exponentially stronger. So in the context of AI, why this becomes relevant, and also, sorry, the supporters mentioned that as the number of people in a group increases, then the capabilities of that group also increases. So, for example, if you had a group of chimpanzees, there's probably a equilibrium or a saturation point as to where they become effective, and the law of diminishing returns applies. Whereas for humans, we become stronger. We have networks of millions of people across the globe. I mean, look, this conversation is testament to that. You were saying your business partner is based in the US and you're calling from Croatia. I'm in London. My business partner and the founder is based in Amsterdam. So we're already, and we're connecting with millions of people thanks to your excellent podcast. So that is testament alone. And sorry, but I'm rambling a bit, but in the context of AI, our ability to come together, form networks, discuss and implement changes to prevent this getting out of control is absolutely essential.
No, don't worry about rambling. We're all here to have a nice conversation and provide value, right? And these things are highly relevant. Yes. Because, you know, we've got people in America, we've got people all over the world, actually, that listen to this. And just because it's an EU initiative doesn't mean that it isn't useful for the rest of the world, right? Because it affects everybody, because often we mirror the US, or the US mirror us, or the UK, you know, the UK, when it was part of the EU, you know, we would mirror the US. But now it's all quite blinkered, isn't it, in terms of the way that it's sort of working. But I'm quite excited about the future also. I share your enthusiasm. I think if you look at, you know, mechanized farming and the Luddites and all these sorts of people that were completely against industrialization and all these sorts of things, they kind of missed out on the boat, right? But the major problem that I have is that people just are just being, they're just busy for the sake of being busy. And actually, AI should really help us to be enjoying our lives more. And I think the smart people are the ones who are leveraging it and actually making time to take back a little bit of time for themselves, because that's what it's really designed for, in my personal opinion. But as far as the EU AI Act, what is it exactly, and what does it mean for businesses, Michael?
The EU AI Act is the world's first comprehensive law on AI. And what it does, it's regulating AI technologies. AI in this context, there's two schools of thought. You have the legal definition and the academic. The academic is AI as we know it, so everything from LLMs, models, machine learning, whatever. Whereas the legal definition, i.e. what the regulation covers, is everything that's automated decision-making based on data. So any model, any system, any algorithm, any prompt is capable of being an AI system. So where there's as the definition states, any degree of automation. It follows very strongly on the OECD's definition, which was changed halfway through the legislative process. And what this, in simple terms, imposes requirements on users, makers, and suppliers of AI systems, and any third party or anyone involved in the value chain. So that would include people providing infrastructure, people providing power, people providing code repositories, people providing servers, etc. Because the whole point is to make sure that any use of an AI system is treated or has regulatory treatment imposed on it based on its risk level. So similar to how financial crime works, which is a risk-based approach to AML, so you have high, medium, and low under the process henceforth known as KYC, Know Your Client. This framework is called, what the team AI partners have coined the term KYAI, Know Your AI System. The risk level of an AI system determines its regulatory treatment. So you have four levels: unacceptable, high, limited, and minimal. And this applies to everything from traditional machine learning, deep learning, to generative AI, or what the regulation terms under chapters 4 and 5, general purpose AI models. And the EU AI Act is also a great example of how it's a dynamic approach to compliance. Most of the criticism we receive from industry is, okay, this regulation is very static. It's not going to be able to take into account of upcoming developments. How can you regulate this? And there's lots of academic theories, which maybe we can touch on. But the regulation actually changed halfway through its legislative process to cover general purpose AI models. But they all fall under, and they're all subject to the overarching risk pyramid. So the risk, the KYA, KYAI approach. The majority of the provisions, and please do let me know if you have any questions or comments, of course, majority of provisions apply to those in the high risk category. So these are the ones that are deemed to pose the highest risk of harm to an individual's health, safety, and fundamental rights. The EUA Act is enshrined based in consumer protection laws and piece of legislation, which include digital principles for the digital decade and the European Charter of Fundamental Rights. And of course, the Treaty of the Functioning of the European Union, the Treaty of the European Union. As you can imagine, it's very much designed to protect the individual, but this applies across B2B, B2C, and B2B2C contexts. So whether you're the end user or you're receiving a service and there's a provision of AI system involved in it, or indeed you're the one making it, you're in scope. And last but not least, the risk of harm, which I mentioned there, is the risk of harm to an individual in the context of financial, spiritual, emotional, physiological, and psychological. So you could argue that a decision taken by AI, say you're applying for a credit score, you're applying for a mortgage or a loan, and then AI administered or driven service is the one that denies you the application and it causes you financial stress, you feel emotional, and you start to maybe physiologically impacted, you could argue that these are the types of systems that they are subject to the high-risk category.
Who actually decides on what categories these said models are actually in?
So the European Commission will not... They provide guidance on what the definition is, what the prohibitive practices are, and there's those two guidances already out, and next year they're providing guidance of high-risk AI systems. But the determination, so the identification of AI systems and determination of the risk level, which is part of the KYA process, has to be done by the firm. Now, whether they do that in-house or they outsource it is entirely up to them. What we are seeing and what the team at AI Partners, we've actually built a RegTech tool or compliance software that allows companies to identify their systems and assign a risk level via a self-assessment process. This system is used for lawyers to service their clients, and it's built and tested by lawyers. So, and it's subject to four eyes checks. So we've adopted this approach on the basis that when companies acknowledge that there's an issue they need to deal with and then allocate resources, they'll go to their lawyers to help them address the issue.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking the other day on about three podcast shows because I was so wound up about what I'm going to tell you. You must have heard of it, I imagine, knowing you. It basically is a chatbot platform that is in America. The people who are what they do is they go on there and they create a chatbot, and the chatbot is basically a young Morticia Adams. So Morticia Adams is like 14 years old. And then, so you have people then talking to this chatbot who is basically sharing indecent images and having risque conversations, I'm going to just say, with the end user. So my personal feeling, I've thought about this a lot, right? Because it's so awful. Because it actually encourages this behavior that no one wants to encourage. Is there blame is everyone to blame along the way? Is the VC firm to blame? Is the infrastructure firm the end user? Who's to blame in this sort of situation?
Well, I think assigning blame is obviously good to know who's accountable, and then you can address the issue. But I think a blame culture is not necessarily one that's productive or progressive. I think, as Article 25 stipulates, that everyone along the value chain has a responsibility. So some will have more involvement and responsibility than others. And of course, others will know the system and the processes and the technology and the people involved far better than others. That being said, everyone should have the same obligation. Sorry, everyone does have an obligation to comply with it, but the severity and the proportionality of that will differ. take, for example, ESG. You know, certain when they're doing their due diligence, certain investors may not invest in ESG prospects or portfolio assets because they're deemed to be greenwashing. And the same phenomenon applies in an AI context where people profess to have trustworthy and ethical products that are compliant with the law, where in actual fact it's the total opposite. And they would take that, you know, they would take that approach to not make a decision or go forward because of that reason. This, and that doesn't just apply at the point of, let's say, pre-procurement, it applies throughout the process. And what we're seeing here is we believe that how companies and how AI companies operate now, it will be ongoing. It won't just be, oh, I've ticked the box, I'm good for another 365 calendar days, I'm just going to leave it. It is ongoing. It is remaining constantly vigilant. And yes, it requires time. Yes, it requires resources. And yes, quite frankly, it can be a slight irritant for companies. But this is the world we're moving into, where we have free-flowing information on a cross-border basis in real time that needs that vigilance and alert. And ultimately, humanity, as I said, we're resilient and we have to adapt and we have to get used to the fact that we need to manage things in real time. In the same way now you can watch any film on Netflix any time of the day, wherever you are, you know, the same thing applies to managing or knowing your KYAI.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. So moving forwards, this is obviously going to create a whole new load of jobs, right? Because people, you know, there's going to be a chief AI officer. We know about that, right? Like, that's a big thing, yeah? A friend of mine runs the Chief Digital Officers Club, which I think has morphed into the Chief AI Officers as well now, right? So that means there are going to be people that are going to be in jobs that have to keep an eye and monitor these things, because you can't let AI monitor itself, right? Like you need to have someone to oversee these sorts of processes and data flow, like you say, right?
2 points there. So on the job creation, if you take your example at the start, the Luddites, yes, jobs were lost in that phase of development, but then a whole new wave of jobs were created and a lot of new opportunities. And arguably, if you look at the 20th century, let's say after certain events in a bear market or a downturn, the entrepreneurial innovation opportunities are arguably at their greatest. It's not when the economy is at, you know, in a very mature stage. So on that basis, with this change, and yes, this is the teething period. This is the period of probably most uncertainty and most fear. But arguably, there's so much opportunity now that people who take the risk today, you know, could really benefit from it in the long run in whatever manner they deem appropriate. Now, your point of oversight of AI is interesting. I like to draw on some research. So there's some academic research produced in 1983. It's called Ironies of Automation and written by a lady called Lizanne Bainbridge. And what she did is she studied how automation used in industrial processes, how that made people more effective. But perversely, what that meant is they used automation to help with oversight responsibilities. Paradoxically, they became less effective at oversight over time, i.e. you become stupider and not able to oversee. So if we outsource stuff to routine tasks, oversight responsibilities to AI tasks on the presumption, hey, the AI has handled it, I don't need to worry about it, your ability to oversee that effectively diminishes with every single second. So in positions where the stakes are very high and the risks are greater, let's say overseeing a nuclear power plant or acting as a, you know, as the prime minister or something like this, and you're going to oversee, you're going to allocate, I'm not saying that would be the case, but just giving an extreme example to make a point, that is where the ironies of automation argument applies.
As a human, you basically lose abilities, right? Because you're outsourcing it to AI. That's basically what you're saying, right?
Is probably one of our biggest muscles. And like a muscle, if you don't use it, it atrophies over time. if you don't use it.
A lot of conversations around this, and it's, and that's why, you know, we see a lot of, we see a lot of writing that is occurring, a lot of AI, a lot of people are just writing like these massive word salads, just drivel, a lot of words that really don't mean anything because they're not actually actively editing, right? So my personal opinion moving forward, just in that space, right, I think there are going to be tons and tons of jobs where people are actually going to be even better at copywriting. They're going to be even better at analyzing and editing information, right, that people are churning out in these, in these massive word salads, to use the term my business partner seems to have coined over the last few years. He's just so sick of so many people just literally sent him these automated responses and post this stuff that's literally doesn't some of it actually doesn't even mean anything. And that's what's so insane. And it's actually damaging a lot of people's attention spans, because they will read this and they'll, and it'll be so dull and so uncaptivating that they literally just don't even bother engaging with it. They literally just ignore it and kind of get used to this sort of mediocre kind of information that's out there. But in terms of what organizations need to do for the EU AI Act and becoming compliant for that, is the first thing they need to do work out, you know, what business they're in, and are most businesses in the AI business these days?
The first thing to do, and this is what we say, is know how many systems you have. And what we see at the moment is a lot of people going straight to step three, which is, what are my legal obligations? What do I need to do? And can you help me? Whereas actually, people, you don't know the extent to which you're exposed until you know, one, how many systems you have, and two, what the risk level is. So this is part of the KYA process. What we say to businesses first is, every single infrastructure you have, internal, external, so on-prem, in the cloud, or on device, know how many algorithms, how many systems, how many models that meet the definition of a legal definition of AI, and get those inventoried. Once you've got those inventoried and you know exactly which member states they're used in, what the status is and the how they're used and all the context of their use, then do the risk assessment. And then you know, because then that will show you, one, all the systems you have, two, a full inventory, and three, the risk levels. And then you can strategize about what to do of that inventory. And then you could say, if take a very simple example, say you did it for 10 algorithms and two were unacceptable risk, eight were high risk. And then after the assessment, you would have 10 reports. You could then go to your lawyer or professional advisor in that sense and say, what are my legal obligations? What do I do? And that will be that, and that will follow a board decision on what to do with them. Because you may have an unacceptable risk system, but that is crucial to your business or is indeed revenue generating. So it may be better for you to just de-risk it to a level where you can actually manage it and not face legal liability. Whereas a higher risk system you have, it may not be needed because its commercial viability isn't in, the benefits don't outweigh the disadvantages of keeping it.
Sorry, I'll stop you there. Can you explain what a high risk system actually would look like versus a low risk system?
Sure. So there's a non-exhaustive list of systems which meet the different definitions of the EU AI Act. So Articles 6, 7, and Annex 3 cover what is a high risk AI system. These include everything that's used in employment, critical infrastructure, education, etc. So these are deemed to be those situations where there's the highest risk of harm, which we referred to earlier, to an individual's health, safety, and fundamental rights. A good example would be is if you use AI in a CV screening context to obviously sift through the sheer volume of CVs you get for job applications, and then the AI basically triages them and then denies people to make the process more efficient. But if the AI system is trained on non-representative data, or indeed the way its algorithms work are prejudicial to those who apply to the job, then that would, you could argue that could be a risk of harm to their health, safety, and fundamental rights. Examples of lower, limited and minimal risk systems could be everything from chatbots to spam filters and video games. Now here's, but this is an extremely important caveat, and I only picked this up really when I looked at the European Commission's guidelines on prohibited AI practices on the 2nd of February, 2025. If you have a low risk system, so the spam filter, which does very routine mundane tasks, but it has any features of an AI system that meet the category of unacceptable risk, it immediately skyrockets to that high risk category, i.e. the lowest common denominator applies. So this is an extremely important thing to be aware of, because it means that in a context, you could have a very basic chatbot that if there's any product upgrades or any or indeed the context of its use changes overnight, and as we know, things do change, and it then ventures into unacceptable risk, it could change from one day being limited or minimal risk to unacceptable risk, and that would immediately put you in breach of Article 5, which could result in fines of 35 million euros or 7% of global annual turnover.
Brutal. Hence why you need an AI compliance officer, right, who is going to basically work alongside whomever is responsible for technology changes. Could be CTO, could be CDO, could be chief AI officer, could be anyone, right, depending on the size of the business, yeah? So I think it's probably quite a good time to actually get involved and learn more about this. If you are looking to get a new job, move into something more well-paid, could be very, very useful. So in terms of how you guys help people, you basically encourage them to make a list of all their systems, what AI features are there, and then basically they go and they fill out one of your questionnaires, and that will help them to work out where they're at, right? And then obviously you guys will help them if they need further support. Is that kind of a fair way to look at it?
That's one way of describing it, but it's you're pretty spot on, so that's good. So the business is split up into three key areas: consulting, training, and software. And what we find at the moment is people would like to understand the regulation before then moving towards any of those other two areas, i.e. they want to know what the regulation is, how they're affected, why, how it affects them, what they need to do, and when it applies. And the key aspect here is AI literacy. So under Article 4 stipulates that anyone using an AI system needs to, or interacting with it, needs to have the necessary level of knowledge, experience, and expertise. And knowing about what the regulation is, what an AI system is, the risks are, is a prerequisite to knowing, or to then implementing a change management program, or however you want to refer to it, that involves following the KYA process. So upskilling people on what the regulation is, and what they need to do is key. It's a privilege to be able to say to you that this week the European Commission acknowledged AI and partners' AI literacy practices in their living repository. So the practices which we give to both of our clients and our employees are now formally recognized by the European Commission.
Fantastic. So are there any specific sizes of businesses that are exempt from this?
There are exemptions for startups and SMEs. And I think there are general definitions of what those would be under separate piece of legislation and European guidance. And I would strongly encourage people who are indeed, if they're looking to get or see if they qualify for those, to take legal advice accordingly. But conceptually, there are exemptions dependent for certain types of businesses. And the reason they've been included is to prevent regulation stifling innovation, which is a common criticism of the law. The European Commission has recognized that the startups and SMEs are the backbone of the new AI economy, and they want to support them, and they don't want to impose overly burdensome requirements on them from day one. And they've shown this by providing a lot of funding schemes via the Digital Europe program. They've set up European factories. They're trying to create a network of data centers and digital hubs, you name it. You know, they're very much pro-innovation, which is counter to popular narrative of the EU.
Well, that's fantastic. So basically, people can attain an AI literacy qualification.
So by taking the course, you get a certificate, and which could meet CPD requirements. And you would also be able to say that that course is part of the AI literacy practices that have been approved by the European Commission.
Super. So that will really help businesses. And I will drop a link somewhere to that if you're listening to this and you want to move forward and learn more about this. I think it's absolutely necessary moving forwards. Most businesses use technology such as this. And if you are and you think you are at risk of losing something or getting in trouble with the EU, I probably would take your time to actually talk to your boss or have a think about it and do this course. So I want to thank you, Michael. It's been really interesting, really enjoyed it. And I'm looking forward to speaking to you again sometime soon.
Thank you again for taking the time. I know you guys are inundated with requests and we're extremely grateful.
Thanks very much for listening to Influential Visions. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thanks.